John Wycliffe, 1330, 1384, produced the first complete translation of the Bible into English. He's called the Morning Star of the Reformation. John Wycliffe is a great hero. Now, he's an Englishman. We'll read this and I'll tell you a few things about him. He taught that the Bible was the sole authority for the believer and that Christ, not the Pope, is the head of the church. And he condemned many of the doctrines of the Roman Church. So he's a brilliant man, and he starts writing public attacks against the Roman Church. And the most important thing he does is he translates the Bible into English. So one of the things that the Roman Church had done, and really still does to this day, is they control information. And you know, anybody who wants to rule authoritatively has to control the flow of information. That's the secret of all dictatorships and autocracies. They've got to control information. And so one of the best ways to control information in the Middle Ages is to keep the Bible in the language only of the educated clergy. So nobody could read Latin except educated clergy. And so you're dependent on what the intermediary tells you it says and what it means. You can't access the information for yourself. And so Wycliffe, understanding the way to break the power of this papal terror, is to translate the source document into the language of the people can read. Although, of course, there's still a lot of people who are illiterate. So not only does he translate the Bible into English, he begins teaching the English how to read. And so you know what happens when people start getting access to information like that. They start to rebel against the people that have held them down for so long. So, obviously, this is something that cannot go unnoticed. Wycliffe actually suggested that not only was the Pope not the head of the church, but he was actually probably the Antichrist. Probably the Antichrist. Now, another thing that Wycliffe does is he begins discipling and training men in the scriptures and then commissioning them to go preach. And so there's an army of preachers that Wycliffe disciples and trains, and they start going out all through England with copies of the scriptures preaching the evangelical gospel. Now, the organized clergy, of course, despised and hated them. And so they gave them a nickname called the Lollards. And a Lollard is just a lazy bum. Essentially because they were making their income from the offerings in preaching the gospel. And so they called them Lollards, which is a pejorative, derogatory term. But it stuck. They took it. As it happens a lot throughout history, to be called Lutheran was initially a derogatory term, a Methodist derogatory term, and a Baptist derogatory term, a Lollard derogatory term, but they took it as a badge of honor to be ridiculed for Christ. So these Lollards are going around preaching the gospel, and the official church starts condemning them and burning them as heretics. And so the Pope publishes an official decree against Wycliffe, condemns him, and calls for his arrest. However, at this particular time, the papacy is not in Rome. It's in France. Do you know anything about the relationship between the French and the English? They wage war pretty much for about 700 years, on and off, on and off. And even to this day, there's not a lot of love lost between them. although, of course, it's a modern world and there's a lot of interaction, and yet still the French look down on the English and the English look down on the French. And so even though the Pope decrees he's a French Pope, and so the English, remember, because they're starting to get a sense of nationalism, said, we're not going to obey a French Pope. And so the England won't surrender him to the French Pope. But eventually, the papacy moves back to Rome, and so Wycliffe is condemned and killed. But 44 years later, now there's a strong Roman Pope, and the body of Wycliffe is dug up. It's fairly decayed, but the body is dug up, and they bring the body before a trial. They try him. It's 44 years later, but they try him, or it's what's left of him, as a heretic, and he's found guilty of heresy. And so they burn him at the stake 44 years later. But just because there's so much hatred of this gospel of free grace, that they actually dig him up, put him on trial, burn him again. So interesting fellow. Next fellow on the list, this is the beginning of the Reformation, fellow by the name of Jan Hus. That's H-U-S-S. Jan Hus. 1370-1415. He condemned the abuses of the church and was burned at the stake. Now, the fascinating thing is Hus is he's from a part of Europe called Moravia. And so even when he dies, a church is formed, a gospel-believing church called the Hussite Church, and it continues. Now, this is the early 15th century, 1400s. So it will continue, and in the 1700s, the followers of Jan Hus become the Moravians. And we're going to talk about the Moravians. They become the pioneers of modern missionary movement. The Moravians had a 100-year prayer meeting from the 1700s into the 1800s. For 100 years, they prayed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop, 100-year prayer meeting that didn't end for mission. And so when we get to the modern missionary movement, which begins in the 1800s, it's really birthed by this 100-year nonstop prayer meeting of the Moravians. But that was birthed and initiated by Jan Hus and his sacrifice, and his followers had carried on this gospel tradition even in the midst of persecution. In Fox's Book of Martyrs, you can read about Hus's condemnation and his trial and his assassination. It says, when the wood was piled up to his very neck, the Duke of Bavaria was so officious as to desire him to abjure, which means to recant. And he said, no, I never preached any doctrine of an evil tendency, and what I taught with my lips, I now seal with my blood. And they burned him at the stake. Another forerunner of the Reformation, although not as great a hero of the faith, is a fellow named Desiderius Erasmus. Erasmus, E-R-A-S-M-U-S. The greatest humanist scholar of the Northern Renaissance, he challenged many church practices. Now, Erasmus stays a Roman Catholic all his life, and although initially he supports Martin Luther, when Martin Luther breaks with the Roman Church, then Erasmus spends the rest of his life attacking him. But Erasmus is really, he's more of a scholar. And he becomes interested in the original sources of the New Testament. And so he learns the Greek language and begins to look for original Greek manuscripts and starts, and he actually translates and creates a Greek translation. That's a pretty good translation that will be some of the foundation for many of the translations that begin to come out of the Reformation. But as he's doing this, he's looking at how ridiculous the Roman Church is at this point. He writes a book called In Praise of Folly, which is basically an attack against the church. It's his church. He doesn't leave the church, but it's an attack against it. Now, his writings go a long way to getting people to look honestly at the Roman Church, and they become very open now when Luther begins to preach and to print. And then our last person, Johann Gutenberg, G-U-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, not known for theology, but he opened the door for the rapid dissemination of knowledge through his printing press. He also inadvertently undermined the authority of the Roman Church, which had controlled the distribution of knowledge for many centuries. So it was the invention of movable type that made the Reformation possible. If it hadn't been for Gutenberg and the printing press, the Reformation could never have spread like it did. It was estimated that at the height of the Reformation, that 1/6, 1 out of every 6 books that were being published were either written by Luther or Erasmus. So this had been made available because of Gutenberg. And it's interesting how inventions tie in with God's work in history and revival. And certainly the internet is sort of the modern day comparison to the printing press. It has made the dissemination of knowledge possible in places where it was impossible before. All right? Any thoughts, questions? We doing okay? Reformation and the Roman Reaction, now 1517 to 1648. We'll look at the Lutheran Reformation first. The Protestant Reformation was the turbulent 16th century religious and political revolution in Western Europe, which ended the supremacy of the Pope and established the Protestant churches. Martin Luther, our first hero, 1483-1546, came to believe Christians are not saved by their own efforts, but by the gift of God's grace accepted by faith. Luther is one of the most fascinating people in church history. He is, on one hand, a mighty saint of God and one of the greatest men of God to ever live. On the other hand, there's a dark side to Luther, which makes him a really interesting character. And we'll look at both sides of him, because his dark sides is more fun than his good side. But his father had been a coal miner, but had prospered. And one of the things that if you stepped into the prosperous middle class, what you wanted is you wanted your children to be educated. And so there's great universities now that are being funded, and this burgeoning middle class is starting to send their sons to university. And so Martin's father, and his name is not Luther, his name is Luder, L-U-D-E-R. Luther is sort of the English translation, but he's known as Martin Luder. His father sends him to the university to become a lawyer. And so he is trained to become a lawyer, and he's processing through that. But one day in 1505, he is returning from visiting his parents, going back to university, and there's a huge lightning storm. And he's terrified. He thinks he's going to die. There's lightning flashing all around him. And so he's hiding under a tree. He's on his knees. And he prays to Saint Anne. I'll explain that in a minute. And he says these words. He says, "Help me, Saint Anne, and I will become a monk." So he's pledging, if you get me out of this, I'll go into the monastery and serve God as a monk. Now, Saint Anne, you might wonder, who is Saint Anne? Saint Anne, according to Roman Catholic mythology at this point, is the mother of Mary. Okay? So what's happened is, instead of praying directly to the Father in the name of Jesus, early Middle Ages we begin to see Mary as the intermediary. Right? So you pray to Mary, she talks to Jesus, and Jesus goes to God for you. But now, Mary has got this elevated role, really, essentially a member of the Trinity. She's too holy to even pray to her. Anne is supposedly her mother, Saint Anne. So what you do now is you pray to Saint Anne, who talks to Mary, who talks to Jesus, who goes to the Father. So he prays to Anne, "Save me and I'll become a monk." Well, he's saved. And so if there's one thing about Luther, is he is a man of his word. Probably if we did a strength finder assessment on Martin Luther, his number one dominant theme is belief. Maybe belief is number one, two, and three, because he's fairly stubborn in his beliefs. But he's made this commitment. So he breaks the terrible news to his father. "I've spent all this money." His dad spent all this money to put him in university, looking forward to his son assuming a position of nobility and respect in the community. "Instead, I'm going to be a monk." I don't know if any of you experienced that. I know breaking the news to my parents after 4 years of university education that I wasn't going to be using that education came as a little bit of a shock. I've ministered to a lot of people who their parents paid a lot of money for their education, and now they get the blow that they're going to be a gospel minister instead. And you can understand that his parents were not too happy. And so he goes into the monastery, and Martin Luther, one thing about him is whatever he does with his whole heart. So if he's going to be a monk, he's going to be the best dang monk the world has ever seen. And so he puts himself through all sorts of terrible ascetic practices to try to be the most holy he could possibly be. He writes, I'm reading from his writings, he says, "However irreproachably," it's not in your notes, "I lived as a monk, I felt myself in the presence of God a sinner with a most unquiet conscience. Nor could I believe that I pleased Him with all of my efforts. I did not love, indeed I hated this just God, if not with open blasphemy, at least with huge murmuring. For I was indignant against Him, saying, as if it were not enough for God that miserable sinners should be eternally lost through original sin and oppressed with all kinds of calamities through the law and the Ten Commandments, but God must add sorrow on sorrow and even by the gospel bring His wrath to bear upon me. Thus I raged with a fierce and most agitated conscience. And yet, I continued to knock away at the Apostle Paul." He's going through a study and teaching the book of Romans. And somehow he thinks the answer is there in Romans, but he can't quite get it. "In this place, thirsting ardently to know what he really meant. Now, during this time, about 1509, he thinks, okay, the secret is to go to Rome. That's where all the holy people are. That's where I'm going to get my answer. So he goes on a pilgrimage to Rome. And when he gets to Rome, he sees the exact opposite. So he sees priests going into houses of prostitution. And, I mean, right there, openly on the streets. He sees pilgrims who are leaving their offerings. He sees those offerings being taken by priests and used for drunken orgies. And in Rome at this particular time, there is a church called Santa Scala. It's still there. Have you seen the movie Luther? It's a pretty good representation. But it demonstrates this scene. There's quite a significant number of steps leading up to the church. And supposedly, those are the steps that Pilate, or that Jesus, walked up as he stood before Pilate. And they had been mystically, supernaturally transported from Jerusalem to Rome. And pilgrims would scale these steps on their knees, praying rosaries, whole rosaries, as they went from step to step. And it was a very painful experience, as you were on your knees a long time. They were scratched, bloody, cut. But Luther does the Santa Scala. So he climbs to the top and he thinks he's pretty excited. Matter of fact, he wishes that more of his relatives were dead so that he could get them out of purgatory with all of his righteous acts. But when he gets to the top, he looks back and he sees all these pilgrims and he has this terrifying thought. What if it's not true? What if it's all just a bunch of lies? And this doubt starts to plague him, is what he sees at Rome. So he goes back and he keeps knocking at Romans, reading Romans, trying to figure out what it means. He says, and I'm quoting from his writings here, not in your notes. He says, I was seized with the conviction that I must understand Paul's letter to the Romans. But to that moment, one phrase in chapter 1 stood in the way. I hated the idea. In it, the righteousness of God is revealed. I hated the righteous God who punishes sinners. But he said at last, meditating day and night, and by the mercy of God, I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that which through the righteous live by a gift, namely by faith. Here I felt as if I were entirely born again and had entered paradise and that its gates had been flung open and that I was born again. Now, he writes that this revelation came to him, and he uses a Latin phrase, when he was in cloaca. In cloaca. Now, that's the Latin phrase for sitting on the toilet. Sitting on the toilet, which, you know, some great revelations can come. Sitting on the toilet. So it's possible that the great revelation that birthed the Protestant Reformation came while he was sitting on the toilet. Or the CR, right? He was on the throne in cloaca. Although it's more likely, in cloaca was a phrase that the monks used to refer to somebody who was depressed. So I'm depressed in cloaca. I'm on the throne. So maybe it's just a reference to his emotional state. I like to think It was an actual reality. He was depressed while he was. That's probably right. On October 31st, 1517, he published his 95 Theses opposing the sale of indulgences to build St. Peter's in Rome. In 1521, he was summoned by the Emperor Charles V to Worms to recant his views. You know, Germans pronounce, the W's pronounce V, so that's not Worms, that's Worms. Okay? So, here's what's happened. Remember, Leo X is the Pope, and all he wants to do is build magnificent structures and purchase Renaissance paintings. So he's trying to build St. Peter's at this time, and it takes a tremendous amount of cash. And so the Vatican is selling everything they can to raise money. And so they come up with this marketing plan, how to raise money for the building, and that's to sell indulgences. Now, indulgences is sort of like a certificate that will reduce your sentence in purgatory. It's like, have you played Monopoly? It's like a get-out-of-jail card, right? You get that certificate, and you can cash in. Now, you can use it for yourself, or you can use it for dead relatives. So this looks like a brilliant scheme, but then to make it even more effective, they hire this fella by the name of Johann Tetzel. Johann Tetzel, and he's the ultimate marketing genius. So he comes up with his whole multimedia presentation, in essence. It's a traveling dramatic show, and they reenact the terrors of purgatory. And there's a whole show that takes place with singing and dancing and costumes and characters and special effects, and primarily to manipulate you, thinking about your dead mother, burning, suffering, the torment of purgatory. And they've got demons painted up, howling and screaming, and work up this whole presentation, and then start passing around the basket. And they even have little songs that they developed, little jingles. Whenever a coin in the basket does ring, another soul from purgatory does spring. So they're creating all these little ditties and little lines and songs and raising large amounts of cash. Well, Tetzel happens to come into the territory where Luther is at, and Luther is scandalized by this. Now, he's still, we don't know when he's had his born-again experience. It's maybe been 1 to 3 years. But he's still very much a Roman Catholic, and he's still very much embracing many or most of the dogmas of the Roman Church. But he's had this encounter, and now his eyes are starting to be open. But this event really causes him to get upset. And so he publishes 95 theses, 95 statements on the Wittenberg church door, which is no big deal. This is just what everybody does. If you're a scholar and you want to have a dialogue with other scholars, instead of posting something on in a blog or something, you write it up, you go to the church door, you hammer it, other scholars go, and they begin to interact with your scholarly paper. And if you ever read the 95 Theses, you can glance over them, you can get them pretty quick, download them from the internet. They're not that radical. You know, all my Christian life, I thought these were some really strong, evangelical, powerful statements, but there's not much in there. It's like it's not what I expected. But it just happens to be the right thing at the right time. You know the concept of the tipping point? It's like the tipping point. And within 3 weeks, because of the printing press, his thesis have been published and distributed throughout all of Germany in 3 weeks. And within 3 months, they've been published on the entire continent. Everybody in Europe has seen a copy. I mean, all the intelligentsia, at least. And so it just begins to spread like fire throughout the continent. And as a result, he gets challenged. Now, when he gets challenged, he begins looking deeper in Scripture. And between 1518 and 1521, he publishes three very important writings that, in essence, lead him out of the Roman Church and cause all of the pressure of Rome to come against him. Now, in 1521, he is summoned by Charles V. Charles V is the Holy Roman Emperor at this time. He is the most powerful man on the planet. The list of nations that he rules over is extensive. Most of Europe is in his sway. And he's powerful, and he's deeply, devoutly Roman Catholic. And so he's angry about this upstart German that's causing problems. So Luther is required to come and stand before him, and all his writings are laid out before him, and there's Charles V himself and the most powerful people in Europe. And the charges are brought, and for a moment, Luther is daunted, and he asks for a day to think about it. But he comes back the next day, and here's what he says, or probably something close to this. "Unless I am refuted and convicted by the testimonies of the Scriptures or by clear argument, since I believe neither the Pope nor the councils alone, it being evident that they have often erred and contradicted themselves, I am conquered by the Holy Scriptures quoted by me, and my conscience is bound in the Word of God. I cannot and will not recant anything, since it is unsafe and dangerous to do anything against the conscience. Here I stand, I can do no other. God help me." And so Charles V immediately ordered him to be executed and to be killed. And as they're taking him and escorting him away, one of the German princes, Frederick of Saxony, who doesn't like Rome interfering in their territory, sends some of his soldiers to kidnap Luther, and they take him to his private castle at the Wartburg. And he's there, I think, almost a year, held kind of prisoner for his own good, while some of the problem dies down. Now he takes that time and he translates the Bible into German in his spare time. So he translates the whole Scriptures into German and publishes it. And it's still, my daughter, who is fluent in German, has a degree in German, she reads her Martin Luther Bible. Her German Bible is a part of her devotion. So you can still read Martin Luther's Bible. It's written in brilliant German. And it begins to go all throughout the nation. And probably his translation of the Bible does as much or more than all of his other writings. As time progresses, many priests begin getting saved and leaving the Roman Church, and also nuns. So here are these nuns who now are saved, and they're looking for husbands. So there's this one convent, 12 of these nuns have gotten saved, and they want to get out, but the sisters, the leaders, have locked them down. They're not letting them out. And so Luther has a friend who is born again, and they work out this deal with another person who is the regular deliverer of fish is what's called a fishmonger. And so he brings his order of fish, these barrels, and they get these 12 nuns and they stick them in the barrels and they secret them out of the convent. And then it's Luther's job to try to find husbands for them. And so he gets husbands for all of them except one, a woman by the name of Katrina von Bora. And she says to Luther, she says, well, since you haven't been able to find anybody, if you asked me, I would marry you. So she basically proposes to him, and he accepts. He accepts. And his friend, Melanchthon, says about this time, he says, we hope that this state of life, married life, may sober him down so that he will discard the low buffoonery that we have often censured. You know what buffoonery is? You ever heard the term buffoonery? You know what a buffoon is? Yeah, it's a fool. It's someone who plays practical jokes. It's someone that always has the wrong thing to say at the right, at the wrong time. He's a buffoon. Martin Luther said, before I was married, he said, my bed was not made for a whole year, or my sheets cleaned, and they became foul with my sweat. So everybody was glad for this union. Katrina bore him 6 children, and the thing that she was... Well, one of the things he loved her the most for is that she brewed his beer for him. He had a special brand of beer. 2 things that Luther loved. He loved to drink beer and he loved to cuss. He's a cussing, beer-drinking German. I married into a German family. My wife's maiden name is Müller. Her whole family is German. And so I appreciate this German side. He's got a stein of beer and he's writing, and his writings are filled with all sorts of expletives. He's just cussing and drinking and preaching the gospel. Powerful.
Filled with the Spirit.
Filled with the Holy Ghost, yeah. He wrote in his lifetime 544 publications, about 60,000 pages of printed material. Luther taught the 5 solas. Sola is Latin for only. So sola scriptura, only the scripture. Sola fide, by faith alone. Sola gratia, by grace alone. Sola Christus, by Christ alone. And sola Deo gloria, for God's glory alone. Luther began his career with a conciliatory attitude towards the Jews, but it soon turned to bitterness. You may not remember, but earlier we talked about the early roots of antisemitism in the church, John Chrysostom especially in the early church, and then throughout the medieval period as they whole communities of Jews were burned and various things like that. Luther picks this up and carries it to a new dimension. He said, I'm quoting, it's not in your notes, about the Jews, we are at fault for not killing them. Rather, we allow them to live freely in our midst, despite their murder, cursing, blaspheming, lying, and defaming. Here's a solution. Set fire to their synagogues and schools. Let their houses be burned and destroyed, and their prayer books and writings in which such idolatry, lies, and blasphemies are taught should be taken from them. Their rabbis should be forbidden to teach on pain of loss and limb. Now, it was Adolf Hitler who used these writings of Luther and had them published and printed and disseminated to show that it was the destiny of the German nation to destroy the Jews among them and to attack these non-Nordic, non-Germanic races. So which is one of the terrible legacies of Luther, his clear anti-Semitism. And last thought here, and we'll take a little break. Luther had an inflammatory style of writing which made any type of reconciliation impossible. There was a chance at a certain point. Melanchthon, who's his associate, had more interaction with the Roman leaders at this time. There was a chance that early on there could have been some reconciliation and the Roman church may have embraced some of the aspects. But Luther's approach made any kind of reconciliation impossible. Just because the nature, his one-sided, pure focus on this is right and everybody else is going to hell, just made that impossible. And it showed up in his writing. So I got a few quotes here. I didn't want to print in your notes, but I'll read them to you. Here's what he said about the Roman Catholics. He said, we should take the Pope, the cardinals, and whatever riffraff belongs to his idolatrous and papal holiness, and tear out their tongues from the back and nail them on the gallows. You know, it's hard to dialogue after that kind of stuff. He said about Erasmus, remember Desiderius, who initially sided with him but then went against him. He said, Erasmus is a snake, a piece of shit, the insane destroyer of the church, the inflamer of the base passions of young boys. I saw him walking arm in arm with the devil in Rome. Okay. No room to talk now. It's just a fight. And Ulrich Zwingli, who we'll look at, a fellow reformer who stood against the Roman church and preached the pure gospel. But they had a falling out about communion. Luther rejected the view of transubstantiation of the Roman church, but his view was not quite far enough, consubstantiation. Zwingli went all the way to the memorial view, that nothing actually happened. It was just a meal to remember. And Luther didn't like that. And so, even though he's one of his men, they're together, he went against him. So he said about Zwingli, I've bitten into many a nut, believing it to be good, only to find it filled with worms. Zwingli is nothing but a wormy nut that tastes like shit in my mouth. So, not much discussion left at that point. Our lesson, and this is good news, and we'll close and have a little break here. God uses very flawed people to accomplish His purpose.
Don't drink beer and don't cuss.
Jeff, there's hope even for you.
Yes. God's alive.
All right, that's good to know. Take 10 minutes.